to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Today, part two of an interview taped January 9th with Con Hallinan of Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. A lecturer in journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz, his recent reports have covered Latin America and the Middle East. In previous reports to Talk Nation Radio, Con Hallinan took a look at potential threats to stability near Iraq's border with Iran. He pointed out the risk posed by the presence of the Mujahideen al-Qaq there. This group of Mujahideen, known as the MEK, has been receiving U.S. support in spite of the fact that the U.S. State Department calls them a terrorist organization. We saw a similar situation during the 1980s, when Afghan warlords were both feared and funded by U.S. leaders. Before we get to that discussion, here's an overview of recent headlines. Iran announced it would take the seals off a nuclear energy plant to begin processing uranium for the purposes of creating energy. The White House issued immediate condemnations, followed by threats of Security Council sanctions. Israeli leaders then began to discuss how they would attack Iranian facilities and what kind of operations might be run. More recently, Sergei Markov, director of the Russian Political Research Institute, said Iran is in a state of bitter cold war with Israel, and he warned that an Israeli attack on Iran would, quote, lead to a significant destabilization of the situation in the Middle East, including a dramatic increase in terrorist attacks by Islamists on Israel. In the past few days, Russia has offered a solution by renewing an offer made in February that it would enrich energy-grade uranium for Iran and transfer it safely there, as the international community looked on and the International Atomic Energy Agency continued to make inspections. In the U.S., analyst Lee Feinstein of the Council on Foreign Relations has suggested this would be a good solution. Europe, though, indicated Iran must stop nuclear enrichment first. And with tensions running high at the Iraq-Iran border, Iran has said it blames America and Britain for two bombings in Avaz, the capital of an oil-rich province bordering Iraq. This occurred January 24th. We pick up our conversation with Con Hallinan as he talks about Iraq and the ongoing U.S. air war near the Syrian border.
You know, Seymour Hersh did a very good piece. His reporting on the military side of this has just been astounding. I mean, after all, this is the person who bought us the story of Abu Ghraib. And his piece, his recent piece in the New Yorker on the air war, is a story that just nobody has touched on. And I'll give you an example. Just last week, there was a protest by the Iraqi government about an airstrike in Fallujah, which killed 11 people in a family. And Americans said, well, there were people that were shooting mortars, and they ran into these houses, and, you know, so we dropped bombs on them. Well, yeah, that's what air bombing does. It's a violation of the Geneva Accords. I mean, one of the very thing very clear about the Geneva Conventions is that if you have a target which is part civilian, you cannot bomb it. That's absolutely an explicit section of the Geneva Conventions. One of the things about air wars is that air wars are just indiscriminate. It's the sort of nature of air wars. I mean, this is the idea that you have these surgical strikes, you know, as if you're taking out somebody's appendix with a 500-pound bomb. It's just nonsense. I mean, they just blow down buildings is what they do, and that they kill large numbers of civilians. They are a way, of course, of avoiding casualties on the part of the bombers. And if you take a look in Vietnam, and if you take a look at the air war from, like, 72, say, to 75, and, you know, this is a period in which, of course, American casualties, you know, drop down to very little, almost nothing. But Vietnamese casualties go up astronomically, and that's the effect of an air war. And, you know, this particular Black Hawk that went down, we don't know why it went down. It could have gone down because of weather. I mean, it could have been shot down. We don't know at this point. They're still investigating it. But I think what happens is that when you get something like this, you know, you get a crash, and or you get this attack in Fallujah, for just a moment, this little air war surfaces. Now, we don't know what the specs of that air war are. And I remember when I was a journalist covering the Vietnam War and covering it in this country, you know, the U.S. military would tell you every bomb they dropped. You know, we dropped so many bombs on this particular target, and we destroyed this duck pond, and we destroyed this bridge, and we destroyed, you know, whatever. I mean, they gave you every piece of ordnance that they used, and they told you the type of ordnance, etc. You get nothing, absolutely nothing. They do not talk about anything they do. They've learned their lesson. They absolutely tell you nothing. So we have no idea what they're doing. We have no idea how much tonnage has been unleashed. The only thing that we know is from Iraqi sources, which are saying that there's this big uptick in the air war, and from Seymour Hersh's material. As a whole, the military on the ground tends to not think very highly of air wars. They like close-in tactical support. In other words, when they're in a firefight and somebody's holed up in a business in a building, then they want, you know, an F-15 or an F-16 or whatever, you know, to come along and take out that building. But one of the things they don't particularly like is indiscriminate air wars, and they don't like it because what it tends to do is generate enormous opposition to the occupation and enormous hate. And we should know this. You know, if you take a look at the Battle of Britain, here that you know the Germans launched this massive air war on Britain, and it made people angry. Didn't demoralize them. It made people, you know, kind of pull together. That's what air wars always do. I mean, there's always this element that it just enrages people and produces, you know, a kind of another generation of dragon's teeth, and then we have to and then the people on the ground are the people who have to deal with the dragon's teeth. So a lot of this stuff that Seymour Hersh is getting is that he's getting it from the Army. He's getting it from the troops that are on the ground, the Marines and the Army. And they're you know, you don't get this from the Air Force. And they're not saying a word about it. But the people on the ground are saying that air wars are, if this is about hearts and minds, air wars are the worst thing that you can do. But, you know, they lower the casualty figures for the U.S., and raise the casualty figures for civilians. The fact of the matter is that there has been probably, I don't know, since the 8th century B.C., there have been smuggling routes that have gone from Syria to Iraq. This is a tremendous amount of goods, black market goods, many of them, and certainly during the period of the embargo, when the sanctions were on Iraq, a huge underground economy developed, a huge black market economy, and you know what you're seeing here is that black market economy. Are there occasionally people moving weapons, moving foreign fighters, etc.? Yeah, of course. I mean, we know that is going on. But that isn't the majority of the smuggling. On the other hand, how can you interdict it? You know, it mostly happens at night. It's in scattered groups. You can't really do a whole lot about it. But what you can do is that you can bomb the towns. Now, what are those towns? The towns that go from the Syrian border, essentially western Iraq, to Baghdad, are overwhelmingly Sunni. And the insurgency is mainly located among the Sunnis. And so, you know, we can say we're interdicting smuggling routes, but what we're really doing is that we're engaged in collective punishment. And we're bombing people because they're Sunnis. We're bombing people because the Sunnis are part of the insurgency. And in fact, we have said this. There was a case about a year and a half ago where they bombed a wedding party. And we don't know who told this to the New York Times. That is, it wasn't It was an anonymous source. I suspect it was someone like Wolfowitz. But, you know, the comment was, well, yeah, sometimes people get hurt. That's what happens in war. And maybe those people will make a decision not to have anything to do with the insurgency. Now, that's an explicit violation of the Geneva Conventions. You cannot, in fact, the Geneva Accords make it quite clear that you cannot use a military power, bombing, you know, artillery, anything like that, to intimidate or a civilian population. Can't do it. I mean, it's quite explicit part of the conventions. And, you know, here was an American high-placed official saying that, well, this is what we're doing. This is part of the policy. We're saying to the Sunnis that these things are going to happen, and therefore it's really not in your interest for this to happen. I mean, that's really scary. That's the kind of thing that really ought to get a person arrested, and they ought to be dragged up before put in the docket in The Hague, because that's a war crime.
There's also the possibility of exacerbating tensions regionally, and we've been talking about those a little bit, but I want to turn to an article in The Scotsman. This is Putin's show of strength triggers fear of fresh nuclear arms race. You mentioned the U.S. increasing its militarization, increasing its nuclear program, and revving up rhetoric. Let's just talk about how this all works internationally, because I know the Russians are dramatically increasing their weapons caches.
There are really a couple of different threads here, and I'm actually doing a couple of pieces right now that I'm working on this. That is, what was the outcome of the last non-proliferation treaty talks in New York City, which was nothing. Nothing basically got done at all. And what you have is that you have the nuclear powers, the major nuclear powers, are making no effort to get not only to get rid of nuclear weapons, which, by the way, is Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I mean, one of the key point about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was the fact that countries that did not have nuclear weapons would agree not to acquire nuclear weapons, and under the condition, A, that they were never threatened with nuclear weapons. Now, the U.S. has already threatened a number of countries that do not have nuclear weapons with nuclear weapons, including Iraq, including the Sudan, including Iran, maybe North Korea, because we don't really know whether North Korea has nuclear weapons or not. But in any case, the one part of it says you cannot threaten a country that does not have nuclear weapons with nuclear weapons, because obviously if you're going to do that, well then, you know, it's in the interest of all countries to acquire nuclear weapons, so that they won't be threatened by nuclear powers. And then the other part, which is very important, is that the great powers, the nuclear powers, agree to negotiate in good faith and to get rid of nuclear weapons, because otherwise what happens is you have this kind of nuclear apartheid, where you have a few countries that have nuclear weapons, and you have the majority of the countries don't have nuclear weapons. Well, what's the percentage in that for them? There's no percentage in that at all. And not only are the nuclear powers not interested in getting rid of their nuclear weapons, but the U.S. is going through a whole process right now. We don't know exactly what the Russians are up to. I mean, they are gaining, they are building up their military, but we don't know what that means in terms of nuclear weapons. What we do know is that the U.S. is in the process of creating another generation of nuclear weapons, smaller, more usable nuclear weapons. Now, that's a violation of the Non-Proliferation Agreement. You're not supposed to continue to build or develop new nuclear weapons. And it also is related to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, because the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty came first. And most people thought, oh, the reason why we have the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is because people didn't want people blowing up, you know, nuclear weapons and polluting the earth. Well, actually, that was the atmospheric testing ban. That was a lot earlier. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was really aimed at two things. It had two points that were the core of it. One is that if you couldn't test, you couldn't develop new nuclear weapons, because you could never know if they would work or not. And two, if you couldn't existing nuclear weapons were completely reliable. Nuclear weapons are a little funny. You know, they're a little slightly unstable. And so, therefore, if you weren't sure that they were reliable, you'd be much less willing to consider using them in a crisis, because the last thing you want to do is to throw a dud at somebody. You know, you're going to start a nuclear war. You want to make sure the thing goes off. And so the key thing was is don't test, because then you can't develop and you can't trust your own nuclear weapons. Well, what the United States did was they found a way around it. They created this nuclear ignition facility near in Livermore, outside of Berkeley, and where they've been able to redesign, using computers, they've been able to redesign a new generation of nuclear weapons and essentially, using computers, test whether their nuclear weapons are going to work. So here, I mean, all of this, what's really happened is the great nuclear powers, and this is everywhere, it's the Russians, it's, you know, it's the Indians, it's the Chinese, the Pakistanis, the Israelis, the British, the French, have essentially said, okay, we've got nuclear powers, none of you can have nuclear powers. Well, it means that countries are going to form, are going to build nuclear weapons. I mean, I think it would be, I don't want to see the Iranians with nuclear weapons, but if I was an Iranian, would I be for building nuclear weapons? Absolutely. You take a look at Iraq, which didn't have nuclear weapons and got invaded and overthrown. You take a look at North Korea, which maybe has nuclear weapons, doesn't get invaded, doesn't get overthrown. What's the conclusion you're going to draw? Hey, as long as you got nukes, people are not going to come in and overthrow your government. I mean, it's just the worst message that we could possibly give on the question of proliferation and nuclear weapons we have delivered. And in this, I want to say we're not alone. You know, the French and the British and the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians and the Pakistanis and the Israelis all share blame on this one.
Well, you know, scientific communities are very worried about this and writing about it. I'm looking at a piece by Jorge Hirsch, January 3rd, 2006, in Signs on San Diego, America's Nuclear Ticking Bomb. And in this piece, he does go through and talk about Iran and their nuclear program and Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as other points we've touched on here. But he is saying that Russia and China are siding with Iran, that it is legally entitled under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium for non-military purposes, and the U.S. is adamantly opposing the restart of any kind of program along
right.
those lines, even for nuclear power.
Right.
What we're seeing are people who wonder, what is the end result of having Russia and China standing together on a subject as dicey as this one? And also, Russia and China developing more of a rapport. China said this year is the year of Russia and China. And we have, again, this increased arms buildup, suddenly, very frighteningly so, in Russia.
You know, it's just amazing. You know, this is where unilateralism gets you. You know, the Bush administration came in and said, where are the big dogs? Where are the big dogs on the block? Everybody else is afraid of us. We're going to do what we want to do. Well, of course, that doesn't work anymore. I'm not sure it ever did particularly work. I mean, maybe there were periods in world history where, you know, where you had an empire that really did have, you know, either an organizational inside or technological inside, and for a period of time they could really pretty much dominate, you know, their section of the world. But no longer. I mean, it's quite impossible in today's world. So the United States came in, you know, the Bush administration came in, and they said, we're going to do what we want to do. Well, of course, all that did was succeeded in scaring the rest of the world. And the Russians and the Chinese, they look at what the United States is doing in Iran, and what they say is, we're getting, particularly the Chinese, are getting a huge amount of their energy from Iran. The Chinese have just signed it's not clear how much, but maybe up to $200 billion contract for liquefied natural gas with Iran. They see the United States going after Iran. they're not so sure that the United States is really that interested in Iran. They're thinking that maybe what the United States would like to do is to cut off energy supplies to China by taking out Iran. Now, maybe they're being paranoid about that. On the other hand, given the way that the Bush administration talks about, you know, the Chinese threat and the growing threat of China, and now there's this campaign against Russia, I mean, they're just very suspicious. They see the United States moving into Central Asia. They see the United States kind of nibbling away at the old Russian empire. And they see the United States stepping up its alliance with Japan, talking about letting Japan be a fully armed power. There's even hints that Japan would develop nuclear weapons. And if you're the Chinese and the Russians, you're looking at this, and boy, it looks an awful lot like the containment policies of the 1950s. And is it dangerous? Of course, it's extremely dangerous. And, you know, we still have thousands and thousands. We have 15,000, you know, we have thousands and thousands of warheads that are on hair trigger. That is, they're ready to launch in 15 minutes. It's what they call launch on, not launch on confirmation, it basically launch on suspicion. Why? This isn't the Cold War. We're not really, we're not really threatened at this point by some nuclear power which is going to start a nuclear war, and yet we have a huge number of these warheads that are in exactly the same status as they were during the Cold War. Is that dangerous? It's extremely dangerous. And, people make mistakes, only these mistakes are going to be very kind of final mistakes. But I think your point about driving the Russians, the Russians and the Chinese are at each other's throat. All it took was the Bush administration to make them buddies again. We might consider as to whether or not that's really good foreign policy. No one likes us anymore. I mean, except Tony Blair. He likes us. But, Europeans don't like us. Europeans are suspicious of us. Russians and Chinese are suspicious of us. We put ourselves in this.
Let's talk about some of the missiles that Russia is actually getting, because, they did get some long-range missiles from the Ukraine, which was an interesting development. Now, of course, they've sort of entered into a corporate partnership with the Ukraine over gas. But what we're seeing is the development of these Topol-M missiles. They're 75 times the power of a Hiroshima bomb. They can fit on a warhead and travel 6,000 miles. And, we're seeing this, again, in the context of new oil wealth, but also a $1 billion budget increase from the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at the end result or the end game here, it almost has to be another arms race, doesn't it?
Well, one hopes that, I'm a curable optimist, so I happen to think that hope springs eternal. I think you need to keep in mind that if you add up the military budgets of every country in the world, you don't reach the U.S. budget. So, even the talk about the Chinese budget going up, and it's a little unclear what the Chinese budget is, and they say, well, the U.S. says it's much higher than it is, and I suspect it is higher than it's stated, but that's the same with the U.S. I mean, for instance, we have a $451.5 billion military budget at this point. But what most people don't realize that it doesn't include things like nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are separate. That's the energy budget. So that's not part of the military budget, even though you think of nuclear weapons as, of course, things that would be part of the military budget. And things like veterans' benefits are not part of the military budget. There's all sorts of things which are hidden in other places or sort of, pushed off into other particular places. And $1 billion, jumping a budget, $1 billion, say, for instance, the United States, is a yawn. I mean, that's someone basically going through the couch and, finding the loose change and, putting it in a jar. It's such a small part of the military spending that we're involved with. I don't think there's any question that the Russians are modernizing their missile fleet. In a sense, I don't blame them. I don't blame, I mean, George Bush has scared everyone to death. And we're all going to end up paying for that. Where this goes in the long run, arms spending is going up worldwide. Those are the figures over the last few years. Arms trade is going up as well. We're the number one, followed by Russians, and then the French and Chinese and things like that. The continuing spending on the arms budget is very difficult to defeat because we've just seen this lobbying scandal that we've had with Abramoff. Well, if you want to really see where the buck goes, you know, check out how much influence the arms companies have and who they give money to in the U.S. Congress, both the Senate and the House. And you can see why it's a very difficult juggernaut to derail. But I do think that one of the effects of it is not only does it drain, of course, social resources and drain the kind of money that we want to spend on things like health care or infrastructure or the environment or education or whatever. But I think also that, you know, when you build up that massive quantity of materials, you're going to use them sooner or later. And that's generally been the direction that things go in. As to whether or not, you know, you could have a nuclear war, I don't know. I mean, you know, a year ago I would have said, no, you know, look, I think we're away from that. But I'm not so sure about that now. You know, what happens if the Chinese, if mainland China, People's Republic of China, gets in a fight with Taiwan? We have said that we will use nuclear weapons in that case. You know, the Chinese are not, if we use nuclear weapons against the Chinese are not going to use their nuclear weapons locally. They have perfect capability of sending ICBMs to the United States. Could there actually be a nuclear war? Yeah. But, you know, what are we doing there? This is not where we ought to be having our nose. We should not be setting up these alliances, which essentially ring China with a series of bases and allies. You know, the thing about when you do that is you make people paranoid. And you really don't want people to be paranoid when they have nuclear weapons. You want them to not feel any paranoia whatsoever. You want them to be sort of cooled out completely. I mean, like, you know, ship them large amounts of Valium or something like that. You know, be calm. We're doing exactly the opposite. We're ratcheting up the rhetoric and increasing the tension internationally.
Con Hallinan of Foreign Policy in Focus lectures in journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz. His recent reports have covered Latin America and the Middle East. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of community radio station WHUS Stores in Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m.